The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. It takes a certain kind of brave to run a business. We see it, we back it.
Well, earlier we were chatting about trade wars, but now we're turning our attention to the money involved in the real wars and the arms trade. We're joined by Andrew Feinstein, founding director of Shadow World Investigations and author of The Shadow World: Inside the Global Arms Trade. Andrew, the war in Ukraine, we're obviously very focused on the loss of human life, the economic costs and consequences of that, and the political instability that it brings. However, this looks like being an enormous earning opportunity for arms manufacturers, sadly, but it does look that way, doesn't it?
Unfortunately, the trade in weapons is a business that counts its profits in the billions of dollars and its costs in human lives. It is a business that flourishes at time of war, at time of conflict. And the Ukraine, unfortunately, is a case in point. Before the conflict even started, we had the situation that chief executive of one of the world's biggest arms companies was addressing his shareholders and saying how great for them the situation in Eastern Europe and the Middle East is because of all the tensions and how good it's going to be for the company and its shareholders. And since the conflict has started, we've seen the share prices of all of the world's defense companies shoot up. On average, they've increased by 26%, but some of them have increased by over 40%. So yes, unfortunately, this is an industry that profits while ordinary people suffer.
There are extraordinary share price increases, and inevitably, you know, the executives who run those companies, investors and shareholders, are going to make a lot of money out of it. But this is a little bit unusual, or am I right in saying that? Because there are, let's say, for example, American arms manufacturers. There are the Russian, many of them maybe state or state-controlled companies that are big arms manufacturers themselves. But as a result of this conflict, Germany is talking about increasing military spending by $100 billion. Other countries in the West are likely to ramp up their spending over the next decade or more.
Absolutely. So what you see from politicians at a time of conflict like this, and of course, there is always conflict in the world. We shouldn't forget that the people of Yemen have been suffering even worse atrocities, abuses, and immiseration than the people in Ukraine for 7.5 years. And most of those atrocities are committed using our weapons made in countries in the West, people in Palestine, people throughout the Middle East and in other parts of the world. So we shouldn't forget that. I think this conflict is so much closer to home that we can, in some ways, in Europe, identify more with it. But the reality is also that, you know, arms, like anything else, I mean, when you buy a car today, the fact that it has a German label on the front of the car doesn't mean that there aren't components from all over the world in that car. And the weapons trade, the arms trade, is very similar. It's an incredibly global industry. So many, many weapons from the West have European components in them, British components in them, American components in them. And of course, whenever there is a conflict that resonates with local voters, politicians, unfortunately, will jump on the bandwagon and use that as an opportunity to massively increase defense budgets. Now, it's worth saying, Richard, that our defense budgets in and of themselves are ridiculously high as it stands. In the post 9/11 world, we have had defense budgets that have got bigger and bigger and bigger. The United States of America recently passed one of its biggest ever post-World War II defense budgets. You mentioned Germany. Very interesting, because this is under a social democratic green coalition. €100 billion increase in the defense budget. And this is born of what the American philosopher C. Wright Mills described as a military mindset, where you see the world through a prism of militarism. So at a time like this, when you see aggressive behavior by the Russian state on the Ukraine, you see very few attempts by America, NATO, the West, to actually try and address any of these things diplomatically. So there's almost a push to conflict on both sides. Although the one is obviously far more aggressive in nature than the other, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. But it's all driven by this notion that there should be military solutions to disputes always. And that sort of mindset is going to mean that in any situation of actual conflict, advantage is going to be taken of that by politicians who, and this is very important, who receive significant donations to their parties, to their election campaigns, and sometimes even personally. The actual spend on this weaponry, an enormous amount of that money goes into corruption. The trade in weapons accounts for 40% of all corruption in all global trade. This is an industry worth $400 to $500 billion a year.
When it comes to the money around the industry, in this particular conflict, it seems to me unlikely that, you know, there are any companies that are selling to both sides of this conflict. It seems very much Russia versus the rest. But because of the component parts and the way that they're sourced globally, is it possible that companies are benefiting from both sides of this conflict?
Of course they are. It's the basic nature of the trade in weapons, not only because manufacture is so globalized, but because, for instance, let's take the case of Britain. Britain has sold over £1.5 billion of weapons and military technology to Russia since 2010. In that same period, there have been over 250 open-ended licenses issued for what is described as unlimited value. So it could be that same amount all over again. So yes, of course, in the current moment where there is the actual conflict, BAE Systems, Rolls-Royce and others are not actually selling to Russia as we speak or in the last few months. But the weaponry and components that they sold to Russia since 2010 are, we can be absolutely sure, being used in the conflict against Ukraine. And the problem is that in the world in which we live, alliances and allegiances shift very quickly. If we then add in the fact that the biggest donors to Britain's ruling Conservative Party are Russian oligarchs, the picture becomes a lot more muddied again.
When you look at the technology itself, for example, Russia is a major manufacturer and exporter of all kinds of arms. China is a customer. India is a big customer. I read not that long ago they put in an order for 600,000 Kalashnikovs for the army. But yeah. Is it the case that there's a bit of sneering goes on about the different tech in the conflict zone? So there are a lot of Russian tanks, and people seem to be saying, well, they're not a major threat. They don't seem to be any good anyway. Is the technology at very, very different standards?
Well, I mean, it depends what Russia has at its disposal right now. So, for instance, again, Britain has sold Russia tanks. So some of the tanks that will be used in the assault on the Ukraine will have been developed, the technology developed, and manufactured in the United Kingdom and exported to Russia. If we do look at Russian equipment on the ground as we speak, it's important to bear in mind that the Ukraine, when it was part of the Soviet Union, was effectively the weapons factory of the Soviet Union. And the Ukraine has continued an industry, obviously not of that sort of scale or level, as during the times of the Soviet Union. So the Ukraine itself is fairly well armed. Russia obviously moved quite a lot of that armament manufacture and technology development into Russia itself after the collapse of the Soviet Union. In general terms, Russian technology and armaments are not at the same standard as American equipment, Israeli equipment, and some European equipment. Some of the Russian equipment is quite advanced and quite good. Quite a lot of it is actually pretty mediocre.
In the situation that we're in now with this conflict, which countries stand to benefit the most from the increase in military spending? Who are the big winners here?
So the big winners are obviously Russia itself. So the Russian weapons manufacturers, the manufacturers of ammunition, et cetera, but then the United States of America produces 40% of all the weaponry that's produced in the world. So wherever there is a conflict in the world, and there will be American weapons and components on both sides for the reasons that I explained in relation to Britain, the US would be the biggest beneficiary, and the top three weapons makers on the planet are American companies. So they will be the biggest beneficiaries of all, but then there will also be British and European companies will stand to benefit not only during the conflict, but also as a consequence of the massive increases in defence spending that you mentioned earlier in the programme.
Nuclear weapons have been talked about during this conflict in relation particularly to Vladimir Putin, whether he might use a small nuclear device. Am I right in saying that the nuclear technology is guarded very closely by states, but the kit around it, that the missiles or whatever it is, that may well be manufactured privately? Or who makes nuclear weapons?
Varies greatly. So in the United Kingdom, BAE Systems, which is a privately owned company, is the main manufacturer of nuclear weapons, nuclear components, and nuclear devices. In a country like Russia, most of the manufacture is done by what are partly or wholly owned state companies. But regardless of whether it's manufactured by private, mixed, or state companies, the state does have ultimate control over nuclear weapons. Although, you know, given the quixotic nature of some of our political leaders of recent years across the world, I'm not sure that that necessarily is a source of great security to us as citizens of Europe, citizens of Eastern Europe, and even citizens of Russia. I find the notion of nuclear weapons of any sort in the hands of a number of our current political leaders very, very disconcerting. But we should also bear in mind that besides Russia, there are a whole range of nuclear powers in the world, some of whom are fairly regularly on the cusp of conflict or engaged in conflict. And here, obvious examples would be Israel, India, possibly Pakistan, although that is far more of an open question, and the United States of America. So the situation that we're seeing in Russia at the moment really brings to us in Europe and the UK, and particularly in Eastern Europe, just how dangerous it is for states to still have access to nuclear weapons. And I think one tiny chink of light from the awful catastrophe that is the Ukraine and the invasion by Russia is that it perhaps is bringing the issue of nuclear weapons to the fore and in focus, that is maybe leading quite a few people to suggest, wouldn't the world actually be a far better place without nuclear weapons?
Well, on that possibly positive note, Andrew Feinstein, author of The Shadow World: Inside the Global Arms Trade, it's been fascinating to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thanks so much for having me.